On this edition of Celebrating Science, Clifford Will on Einstein's Theory of Relativity. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, Was Einstein Right? Professor Clifford Will examines how the most celebrated scientific theory of the 20th century has held up under the exacting scrutiny of planetary probes, radio telescopes, and atomic clocks. Clifford Will obtained his PhD from Caltech and is now a professor of physics at Washington University. In addition to writing popular books, he is the author of over 160 scientific articles.
Einstein's general theory of relativity is one of the most remarkable creations of the human mind. This theory has changed forever the way we think about space, about time, about the universe as a whole. Some scholars and thinkers have even written that general relativity has changed the course of art, philosophy, poetry, psychology, even the course of human history. My favorite example of how relativity may have changed the course of history comes from the conservative British historian Paul Johnson. In 1983, Johnson wrote a book, a popular history of the 20th century, called Modern Times. Johnson's book begins with the following sentence: "The modern world began on," and he gives a date. Now, if you were writing a history of the 20th century, what date would you choose to begin your history of the 20th century? Any thoughts? Beginning of August 1914, very important symbolic date, but that's not the date Johnson chose. Any other dates? What about January 1, 1900? Or if you're obsessive compulsive, January 1, 1901. But no, that's not the date either. Johnson's book begins with the sentence, "The modern world began on May 29th, 1919. What happened on May 29th, 1919? On that day, there was a total eclipse of the sun that passed over northern South America and across the Atlantic and over western Africa. And in the course of that eclipse, teams of British astronomers measured the bending of starlight in agreement with the prediction of Einstein's theory of general relativity. To Johnson, this historian, the success of relativity in science was accompanied by a rise of relativism in morality and politics and ethics. And to him, this moral relativism was responsible for all the great genocides and catastrophes of the 20th century. In other words, Johnson blames it all on Einstein. Now, that's a topic for a whole other lecture involving experts that are much more expert in this than I, but it simply illustrates that to some people, relativity's influence extends well beyond the realm of science. Now, Einstein, of course, invented his special theory of relativity in 1905, during this miracle year whose centenary we and other physicists around the world are celebrating this year. But even though he had these great successes during that year, he himself remained an obscure German physicist. Sure enough, he rose rather steadily in the ranks of German academic science, reaching a professorship by 1911, but he was pretty much unknown outside those circles. And when he developed the general theory of relativity 10 years later in 1915, he still remained a rather obscure scientist. And even news about the general relativity only slowly leaked out of wartime Germany. Remember, this was still the middle of the First World War. But it was really these 1919 measurements of the deflection of starlight that made Einstein an international celebrity. When the results were announced, newspapers around the world proclaimed him the successor to Newton, establishing a new world order where nothing was where it seemed, and so on. He appeared on the cover of the Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung, sort of the Newsweek of the day. So already in 1919, he was a cover boy. And for the rest of his life, he was famous. He was just the symbol of science. And you know, many of us have seen the famous pictures of Einstein in many places and throughout the years, with Leo Szilard writing a famous letter to Roosevelt concerning the atomic bomb, playing the violin in the Berlin synagogue, well, whatever he's doing there, ticker tape parade down some street with Charlie Chaplin in Hollywood, with the Hopi Indians in Arizona, here with David Ben-Gurion, president of Israel, here in Santa Barbara, showing that learning relativity is as easy as falling off a, well, never mind. And even songs were written about Einstein. In fact, the most well-known and beloved song in the world, especially if you're a movie lover, is about Einstein. Well, the prelude is about Einstein. The song that everyone loves and knows doesn't mention it, but the prelude is about Einstein. And here it is. This day and age we're living in give cause for apprehension with speed and new invention and things like fourth dimension. Yet we get a trifle weary with Mr. Einstein's theory. So we must get down to earth at times, relax, relieve the tension. And no matter what the progress or what may it be proved, the simple facts of life are such they cannot be removed. Name that tune. Nobody? Herman Hupfield, 1931. What? You must remember this. A kiss is still. And long after Einstein's death, he still remained a celebrity, the symbol of science, the symbol of genius. Here, Newsweek on a cover story about genius has Einstein. Time magazine famously proposed Einstein as the man of the century. But ironically, even though it was the general theory of relativity that brought Einstein such fame, by the middle 1920s, Einstein turned the bulk of his scientific attention away from this theory and embarked on what we now believe was ultimately an unfulfilled quest for a unified theory of the interactions. At around the same time, around the middle 1920s, the entire subject of general relativity went into a decline. So that by the end of the 1950s, general relativity was considered to be in the backwaters of physics and astronomy, not a fit subject for a serious scientist to pursue. Well, how could this have happened? If this was such a remarkable creation, such a wonderful theory, how could it have fallen into the backwaters? How could it have gone into such a decline? Well, I think there were two factors that led to this decline. One factor was a prevailing sentiment in those days that general relativity was incomprehensible. It was too difficult for ordinary mortals to understand. There are many famous stories that express this idea. My favorite has to do with Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington, the British astronomer who headed up the teams that went to Brazil and North Africa to measure the bending of starlight in May 1919. 6 months later, in November 1919, Eddington made a report to the Royal Society of London on the measurements, the results of the analysis of the data. And after his talk, and he's closing up his laptop and powering down his PowerPoint, and oh wait. After his talk, a colleague came up to him and said, oh why, with stars in his eyes, and said, Professor Eddington, you must be one of three people in the world who understand the general theory of relativity. To which Eddington said, oh tut tut, he was British, and they said tut tut in those days. Oh no, 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 no. And the colleague said, oh Eddington, don't be so modest. Eddington said, what modest? I can't think who the third person would be. But this idea that the theory was incomprehensible, was too difficult for ordinary people to understand, was an impediment to progress in the subject. It was not a subject that would ultimately enter the normal physics curriculum that young people would study, in comparison with the other branches of physics that were growing in those days, like nuclear and atomic and particle physics. So the idea that it was so difficult to understand was an impediment to its moving forward. A second factor that led to this decline, I believe, was the prevailing view again in those days that apart from a few effects that Einstein himself calculated, the bending of starlight, the perihelion advance of Mercury, which I'll discuss momentarily, and the gravitational frequency shift of light, which I'll also discuss, apart from these very tiny effects that the theory predicted, there was a prevailing idea that the theory didn't really have much to do with physics or astronomy, didn't have many observational contacts. Even Einstein himself was rather blasé about the experimental implications of the theory. In November 1919, when he received a telegram from England reporting that the British astronomers had measured the bending of light in agreement with his theory, he casually showed the telegram to his student, Ilse Rosenthal Schneider. She was astonished at his serene reaction to this wonderful news, and she said, "Why, Professor Einstein, what would you have said if the measurements had disagreed with your theory?" And he said, "Well, then I would have felt sorry for the dear Lord, for the theory is correct." Later in 1930, he wrote, "I do not consider the main significance of the general theory of relativity to be the prediction of some tiny observable effect, but rather the simplicity of its foundation and the consistency of its structure." So even his own attitude seemed to be rather blasé about experiment. But of course, this is not how science works. A subject that is all theory with no experimental contact to verify the theory or to allow one to modify the theory in the proper direction is in danger of becoming a sterile subject. Conversely, a subject that is all experimental data with no theory to try to take that data and put it together in some kind of coherent picture of nature is also a sterile subject. The subjects that thrive in science, not just physics, but all of science, are those in which there's an interplay between experiment and theory. And I think this is what happened in general relativity. The absence of any kind of serious experimental contact made general relativity into a sterile subject, and by the late 1950s, it was believed to be in the backwaters of physics and astronomy. First, in 1961, came the discovery of quasars. Quasars are extremely powerful, but extremely point-like sources of radio waves, optical radiation, all forms of electromagnetic radiation that we see almost to the edge of the visible universe. They are among the most distant objects we know, yet they are, on astronomical terms, extremely bright. We now believe that the central engine of quasars, of a typical quasar, is a supermassive black hole weighing between maybe a million to a billion times the mass of the sun. Clearly, black holes are something that need general relativity in order to understand them. Next, in 1964, came the discovery of the so-called 3-degree background radiation. This is the radiation from an earlier phase of the universe, roughly 380,000 years after the Big Bang, that we now see today coming at us from all directions, that was emitted from the hot early universe. Well, clearly, general relativity has a role to play in understanding the origin, evolution, and structure of the universe. Next, in 1967, the discovery of pulsars. These are strange stars that emit pulses of radio waves to the Earth, everywhere between anything between 1,000 pulses per second down to maybe a pulse every few seconds. We now understand these objects to be neutron stars, stars with roughly the one to one and a half times the mass of the sun, but about as size as Kitchener-Waterloo in diameter. These are extremely condensed, extremely small objects, yet with the same mass as the sun, spinning on their axes and emitting a radio beam, much like a lighthouse, along a magnetic field that's misaligned with the spin axis. And every time that magnetic field beams its radiation toward us, we see a beep of radio waves. Neutron stars are so condensed that general relativity is needed to understand their structure. Finally, in 1971, came the discovery of the first black hole candidate. This is an object that emits X-rays. It was discovered by one of the first X-ray satellites launched above the Earth's atmosphere. A source of X-rays in orbit around a companion star. That's the source of the X-rays. There's the star. And we now believe with very high confidence that the X-ray source is actually a black hole that's sucking matter off the atmosphere of the star. The matter heats up just before falling down the hole and emits X-rays. Again, black holes, you need general relativity to understand black holes. So these kinds of discoveries gave astronomers the sense that they would need to understand general relativity in order to explain these kinds of exotic phenomena. So this is one factor that led to this renaissance for general relativity beginning in the 60s. A second factor that led to this renaissance was the development of a new way of thinking about the theory. The old way of thinking, sort of from Einstein's day, was very much focused on the abstruse mathematics and mathematical niceties that tended to obscure what was really going on. But this new way of thinking, pioneered by people like Hermann Bondi, John Wheeler, Kip Thorne and others, focused on the observable aspects of general relativity. They focused on doing calculations in a way that really told you what you could measure when you were in curved space-time. This had a number of important effects. It helped to streamline one's understanding of the theory. It was no longer so incomprehensible as it was believed to be years before. It also, unimportant factor, it also led to new generations of textbooks that presented general relativity in a pedagogically sound way, in a simple, streamlined way, that allowed one to teach general relativity in normal courses. These days, most graduate programs in physics teach a course in general relativity, and many of the larger physics departments now teach undergraduate courses in general relativity. And one shouldn't ignore the impact of that factor, because without young people learning a field and entering that field to produce the research advances of the future, a subject is in danger of becoming sterile. So having a new way of teaching this subject was extremely important in bringing young people into the field. This was a development also that had its origins in the 1960s. The third factor that I think led to this renaissance was the development of high precision technology, the technology of precision measurement that also began around the 1960s and that we all benefit from today. This is the technology of lasers, radar, atomic clocks, together with all the machinery associated with the interplanetary space program that led to new ways to measure some of these tiny effects that general relativity predicted. After all, if you want to understand quasars, black holes, neutron stars in the universe, you would like to know whether or not general relativity is the correct theory to be using, or whether you should be using some other theory. So the new technologies of the 1960s led to new tools, new ways to test Einstein's theory to see if it really is the right theory to be used. A result of that was a worldwide program over the subsequent years to put Einstein's theory to the test. And that's what I want to focus on in this lecture. First, I'm going to describe the bending of light, this famous experiment that made Einstein famous. Then I'll talk about a second of these famous tests that Einstein himself devised, having to do with the orbit of the planet Mercury. And I'll describe how that has had its ups and downs, but is now a triumph for general relativity. Then I'll talk about whether or not space-time does the twist. I promise you will not see me dance. You've heard me sing, but you won't have to see me dance. But I'll explain what that means. Then I'll describe the search for gravitational waves, a very important prediction of general relativity, and I'll describe why we know they exist, but why we still haven't yet detected them. Finally, I'll talk about the effect of gravity on time, and talk about why Einstein is important in your daily life. And that's a place where you're allowed to laugh. But let me start with the bending of light. According to general relativity, space is not flat like this stage, but rather it's warped, it's curved, it's bent by the presence of mass. Mass warps space and time, and it's that warpage of space-time that is responsible for gravity. And one immediate consequence of that is that light will no longer travel on what you think of as a straight line if it passes by a body like the sun, but will in fact be deflected in its path. So that light from a star over here, passing by the sun, entering a telescope over here, will appear from the point of view of the telescope to have caused the star to shift in its position slightly. So it'll appear the star has moved from there to there because of that bending of light. So this suggests then a very simple experiment that you could do to test whether or not light is bent by a body such as the sun. You simply go out at night and take a photograph of some field of stars in the sky. And then 6 months later, after the Earth's orbit around the sun has put the sun in that same position in the sky, you then take a photograph of the same group of stars. And the important thing about the bending of light is that the further the light is in its passage from the sun, like for a star way out here, the less the effect. So here, the star is hardly affected at all. Stars closer to the sun have their positions deflected by a larger amount. And a star very close to the sun, whose ray just grazes the surface of the sun, is deflected by an amount of 1.75 arc seconds. I remind you that an arc second is 1/3600th of a degree. An arc second is the angle subtended by my finger at 2.5 miles. Okay, so it's a very small angle, but it's not, astronomers can routinely measure such angles. So what you do is simply take a photograph of the stars when the sun is there, and then measure how much each of the stars has been shifted, and see if the amount agrees with general relativity. Just one problem with this experiment. What's the problem? There are no stars in the sky when the sun is there, because the sun is there. Right? This, of course, is why you have to wait for a total eclipse of the sun, when the moon goes in front of the sun, blocking its light, and you can start to see stars near the sun. And this is actually a reproduction from one of the plates from the 1919 expedition of Eddington. So there's the moon in front of the sun, there's the solar photosphere, and there are tick marks there. Now, they're provided by God, but the astronomers added them later. And you can't tell the stars from dirt on the view graph, but anyway, there are, I assure you, stars between these tick marks that you can photograph. And you compare the positions of those stars with the photograph of the same stars taken at night and see how much each one has shifted. And then this was the basis for Eddington's report of a successful confirmation of Einstein's theory. But there's one problem with these experiments, and it's a problem that I discovered a few years ago, and I named it Will's Law. And I'm just awaiting my call from Stockholm any day now. I missed out on this year, so I'll have to wait till next year for my prize. Will's Law states that total solar eclipses must never occur over fine astronomical observatories, but instead solar eclipses must only occur over roiling oceans, steamy jungles, or swirling desert sands. And this was true of Eddington's expedition. For example, in Africa, there was a huge rainstorm right up until the last moment before totality of the eclipse, and the clouds only began to clear slightly when the eclipse was in its maximum phase, and so he could only see a small fraction of the stars that he could hope to see. Similarly, in 1973, when a team from Princeton University and the University of Texas went to Mauritania in West Africa during a total eclipse to do the same kind of experiment, they, of course, in 1973, had the benefit of a computer-controlled telescope and the fanciest Kodak photographic emulsions for taking their photographs, but they couldn't control the weather any better than Eddington did. There was a huge dust storm during the eclipse, and so they could only see about 15% of the stars they hoped to see through the dust. Unfortunately, my law was broken several years ago, about 5 years ago, when there was a total solar eclipse over Hawaii, over Mauna Kea, which happens to have some of the world's finest astronomical telescopes in it. So I'm calling that spontaneous symmetry breaking, so maybe there's still a hope for my Will's Law. But these kinds of eclipse experiments were beset by these sorts of environmental problems, and so they were always limited in accuracy. But in the meantime, an entirely new method came along for measuring the bending of light. And that exploited two of the things I've already mentioned that came along around the 1960s. First, the development of radio astronomy, very high precision way to measure angles of radio sources. And in fact, these days, radio telescopes, more particularly arrays of radio telescopes called radio interferometers, can measure angles between radio sources at the level of 100 micro arc seconds. That's 100 millionths of an arc second. So they have very fantastic precision in angular measurements. On top of that are these quasars that I've already mentioned that were discovered in the 1960s, these very point-like, intense sources of radio waves. So the idea would be then to measure the bending of radio waves from these quasars using radio interferometry. And this technique was developed in the late 1960s, and many measurements were made. And here's an example of how such a measurement might work. Two particular quasars, 3C273 and 3C279, are in the sky. Those are just catalog names from a certain catalog of quasars. And every fall, the sun passes by them. So that on September 28th, the sun is here. And if you measure the angle between the two quasars, and that's what radio interferometers are best at, measuring the relative angle between two radio sources. If you measure the angle here, then you're going to get the nominal undeflected angle between the two, because the sun is way over here, and none of the light passes close to the warped space-time near the sun. But as days pass, the sun gets closer and closer. On October 3, it's here. October 8, it sits here. So now the light from this quasar passes close to the sun, and so the image of this quasar is going to be shifted. Here is the first quiz of this talk. Which way does the image of 3C279 shift? Does it go this way or does it go this way? And we'll have to vote. How many vote this way? How many vote this way? I'm impressed in two things. A, that you got the right answer, that's this way. And B, that you voted at about double the rate of a typical American election. Okay? Well, here's question number two. So what happens to the angle between the two quasars? Will it increase or decrease? Sorry? Everyone agree with that? Increase. Okay. October 9th, actually, you get no data. It actually goes right in front of 3C279 in this case. October 10th, which way does the image of 3C279 go? How many vote this way? We're getting good. How many vote this way? Okay. Actually, the voting rate was less. Now I'm a little troubled by that. And then on October 15th, the angle returns to the nominal undeflected angle. So what you do is plot the angle between the two quasars as a function of time. It increases, no data for one day, then it's less than normal and back to normal, and compare the shape of that curve with the detailed prediction of general relativity, and you can ask whether the results agree. And a recent measurement, actually, in 2004, that involved measuring angles of 541 quasars distributed over the entire sky led to an agreement with the prediction of general relativity to two parts in 10,000. So this is very high precision measurement in agreement with Einstein's theory. But that's not the end of the story for the deflection of light. In 1979, astronomers discovered a very strange quasar. In fact, they discovered two quasars. These quasars were very strange because they were extremely close together on the sky, much closer than you would ever have expected on the basis of random chance. And furthermore, they looked almost like twins of each other. They looked almost identical. Very quickly, the astronomers concluded that what they were seeing was not two quasars, but a single quasar, and that somewhere between that quasar and us, there's a big cluster of galaxies. And as the light passes through the warped space surrounding that cluster of galaxies, it's taking two different paths to get to us. So the one quasar is being split into two separate images. I mean, some of you may have experienced this. I've never done this myself. But when you're inside a bar and you're looking through the modeled glass that you see in the glass of the bar and you see multiple images of people outside trying to look in and see who's there, I wouldn't know any of this myself. But maybe you've seen multiple images from glass. This is the same kind of an effect. But here, it's curved space-time that's acting as the lens, not glass. And since that time, this field of gravitational lenses has exploded and become a major astronomical tool. And here are some just beautiful examples of astronomical lenses. Here's one case where a quasar has been imaged into five separate images by an intervening galaxy. In some cases, if you have the quasar and the galaxy or cluster is perfectly lined up between us and the quasar, then the light can take infinitely many ways to get around us. It can go any way it wishes around the galaxy. And so this one quasar can be imaged into a perfect ring. It's called the Einstein ring in honor of Einstein. And there's an example of an almost perfect Einstein ring. There's another one. And here are cases where quasars, these point-like quasars, are distorted into little arc-like shapes by the intervening curved space-time surrounding a cluster or a galaxy. In the late 17th and early 18th century, you might have said that Newton's theory of gravity was one of the most remarkable creations of the human mind. After all, this universal theory of gravity was capable, with one simple proposal, to explain the fall of apples on Earth and the motion of the moon around the Earth, and the motion of planets around the sun, and the motion of satellites around their planets, and so on. It could even explain the tides, account in detail for the tides of the Earth. All the details of celestial mechanics could be explained by this remarkable Newtonian theory of gravity. But in the middle of the 19th century, a problem arose. The problem was pointed out by Jean-Joseph Le Verrier, who was then the director of the Observatoire de Paris. Le Verrier had already become famous some 10 to 15 years earlier by noticing that if you look at the orbit of Uranus, it undergoes some slight wobbles, some deviations that could not be accounted for by Newtonian gravity. Le Verrier, and independently Adams in England, realized that these deviations could be produced by an additional planet further out whose gravitational tug on Uranus could produce such wobbles. They even could predict roughly where that planet should be and its characteristics, and later that planet was indeed discovered by German astronomers, and that's the planet we now call Neptune. So Verrier was already famous, but he turned his attention to another issue in the solar system, and that was Mercury. According to Newtonian gravity, the typical orbit of one body around another is an ellipse, with the sun sitting at a focus of the ellipse, and the short axis of the ellipse is called the perihelion, where the planet gets closest to the sun. According to Newtonian theory, that ellipse should always remain fixed in space. Its axis should always be the same, never changing. But that's not what astronomers observed. Astronomers observed that the ellipse was rotating very slowly at a rate of 575 arcseconds per century. Again, it's a small effect, but measurable, and they really knew what it was by observation. So is this a catastrophe for Newtonian gravity? Well, to Le Verrier, obviously not. Since he was already an expert on perturbations of planetary orbits by other planets, he said, well, clearly the solution of this problem is that Mercury is being perturbed by the other planets in the solar system, and if I work out those perturbations, I should be able to account for this shift in Mercury's perihelion. So Le Verrier sat down to calculate the contributions of all the planets to Mercury's orbit. The first contribution comes from Venus, the next planet out, and he got 278 arcseconds as the contribution due to Venus's perturbing gravity field. Earth, the next planet out, contributes about 90 arcseconds. The next big contribution comes from Jupiter. Even though it's much further away, it's a very massive planet, so it produces a hefty amount. And then Mars and all the other planets that Le Verrier knew in those days produce about 10, and if you're adding these things up in your head, you discover the problem that Le Verrier found. The total is 532 arcseconds per century, short by 43 arcseconds. Did not agree with the observation. No one could account for this discrepancy. People proposed, in the spirit of Le Verrier, another planet between Mercury and the Sun. They even gave it a name. They called it Vulcan, after the Roman god of fire, because it would have to be a very hot planet. But astronomers searched for Vulcan for decades and found no evidence whatsoever of an additional planet between Mercury and the Sun. And for the rest of the 19th century, nobody could come up with an explanation for this discrepancy in the perihelion advance of Mercury. And it was one of the great crises of 19th century physics, similar in some ways to the crises that led ultimately to quantum mechanics and special relativity. It was an unsolved problem. Well, when Einstein completed the general theory of relativity in November of 1915, he realized that his equations for gravity, although they had Newton's theory as a first approximation, had additional correction terms that he would have to take into account. And so he said, well, let's take into account these additional relativistic terms and see what they produce. And lo and behold, he came up with 43 arcseconds per century, exactly what was needed to account for the discrepancy. He later wrote to a friend that he had palpitations of the heart when he finished this calculation. He was so excited. He could not sleep for weeks because of this wonderful result. If you can imagine having solved with a simple one fell swoop this 50-year-old problem, I can only imagine what it must have felt like. He was beside himself. Well, the story here also doesn't end with that triumph of 1915. We now know with much higher precision the discrepancy that has to be explained. First of all, we know much better the orbit of Mercury, mainly by bouncing radar signals off the surface of Mercury, so we know its orbit to very high precision. Furthermore, we know from all the various planetary spacecraft that have gone by the other planets, we know their masses much better than they did in 1915. We know their orbits much better, so that we can calculate these correction terms with extremely high precision. So the modern value of the discrepancy that has to be explained after you've subtracted all the planetary perturbations is 42.98 plus or minus 0.04 arcseconds per century. So this is a part in a thousand accuracy in the discrepancy that has to be explained. That's what's observed. For the past 16 months, there's been an experiment orbiting the Earth launched by NASA and Stanford University called Gravity Probe B. The experiment just ended, actually, a few weeks ago. The idea of this experiment was to put into orbit around the Earth, it's actually into polar orbit, an array of gyroscopes. There are four gyroscopes, just spinning balls. And the idea is to measure whether or not those gyroscopes always point in the same direction. They're initially aligned, pointing all toward a given distant star. It's the star Ion Pegasus, actually. And the idea is to ask the question, do these gyroscopes point always in that direction, or do they somehow shift a little bit in their direction? Ordinarily, you think of a gyroscope as always pointing in the same direction. That's how you use gyroscopes for inertial guidance. They always seem to point in the same direction. But according to general relativity, gyroscopes in warped space-time can shift a little bit. There are two separate effects that can cause a little shift in the direction of a spinning gyro. One is called the geodetic effect, and that's simply the effect of propagating a gyroscope around a curved space-time that surrounds the Earth. You can actually do a simple example of this taking a globe in your own living room, just a globe of the Earth. Take a stick and move it so it's always parallel to itself along the globe, say starting from the equator and going up to the North Pole. Then come back down from the North Pole to the equator along a line of longitude 90 degrees displaced from the first. And then go back along the equator to where you started from, and you'll see that your stick is not pointing in the same direction that it was, even though you've kept it parallel to itself all the way around. That change in direction of something that ordinarily is always in the same direction is the hallmark of a curved space, and there's an analogous thing in the curved space-time surrounding the Earth. That produces an effect of 6,600 milliarcseconds per year, 6.6 arcseconds per year. Very tiny effect, but that's measurable. But the second effect, a much smaller effect, is what this mission really wants to measure. I've told you that a body like the Earth or the Sun warps space-time. But if the body is also rotating, then it has a tendency to drag space-time around with it. Much as if you took a stick in a vat of molasses and turned the stick, the molasses will start to swirl around the stick, caused by viscosity in that case. But here, it's actually space-time that's being slightly dragged around with the Earth as the Earth rotates. And that dragging of space-time will also cause gyroscopes to precess a much smaller amount, only 42 milliarcseconds per year. Well, this Gravity Probe B was launched to measure these two effects. Its goal was to make a measurement at the level of 0.4 milliarcsecond per year, so it hopes to measure this effect to about 1% precision. It was launched in April of 2004 and just ended a few weeks ago. The experiment exploits superconductivity to have very sensitive measuring devices on board, and it only had so much liquid helium to make everything run at superconducting temperatures, and the liquid helium ran out as scheduled just a few weeks ago. Here's what the gyroscopes look like. They're spheres of fused quartz. That's a hand and a thumb and a finger, so you see how big they are. They're just little things. Coated with a thin layer of niobium, which becomes a superconductor at low temperatures. In order to reduce unwanted drifts in the direction of the gyroscope produced by gravity and other extraneous disturbances, it turns out these gyroscopes have to be spherical and homogeneous in their density to about a part in 10 million. Manufacturing such objects was a major challenge for this project, and here's an example of how well they did. This is a diagram using lasers showing the difference between the highest mountain on such a gyroscope and the deepest valley. That difference is so small that if you took one of those gyroscopes and blew it up to the size of the Earth, then the difference between the highest mountain on that Earth-sized gyroscope and the deepest valley would be my height. That's how spherical they are. But that reduces unwanted effects that they really aren't interested in and leaves only the relativistic drifts as the things that they want to measure. And here are some other pretty pictures of some of the apparatus. I'm a theorist, so I like to show pictures of apparatus so you think that I actually understand what these people do. But it will be about a year to a year and a half before all the data from this mission is analyzed, so we'll have to wait for some future talk to find out if Einstein was right about space-time doing the twist. Next, let me turn to gravitational waves, a very important prediction of Einstein's general theory of relativity. And one way to talk about gravitational waves is to try to compare and contrast them with electromagnetic waves, with which many of us are more familiar. So electromagnetic waves, you know, are produced, say, in an antenna when you have moving electric charges in some varying current. Those moving charges then emit an electromagnetic wave, which is an undulating wave of electric and magnetic fields that propagate through space with the speed of light. When those waves reach another electrical conductor, they can cause charges to move. Those moving charges produce a current. Current goes down and produces something, say, in your TV set. These were discovered in 1887 by Hertz, have many practical as well as impractical uses. There are some similarities and some important differences between electromagnetic waves and gravitational waves. Electromagnetic waves are produced by motion, so are gravitational waves. That's a similarity. But here it's moving masses. So here, moving a double star system will emit gravitational waves. A black hole eating a star will produce gravitational waves. The collapse of the core of a supernova. You think of a supernova as an explosion, and much of what we see is part of the exploding outer shell of the star that's undergone this catastrophe. But the inner part of the star typically implodes to produce either a neutron star or a black hole. Under the right circumstances, that imploding core can produce gravitational waves. But unlike electromagnetic waves, which are varying electric and magnetic fields, gravitational waves are ripples in space-time itself. Much like the ripples on a pond are ripples in the two-dimensional surface of the pond, gravitational waves are ripples in the four-dimensional fabric of space-time. According to general relativity, they propagate with exactly the same speed as light. That's a firm prediction that comes out of the mathematics. And when these gravitational waves impinge on some object, whereas electromagnetic waves will make charges move, gravitational waves will make masses move. But now here's one big, big difference between gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves. The strongest source we could imagine, the collapse of a core in a supernova, or the merger of two black holes, for example, in our galaxy, very nearby us, would cause a change if you had two masses separated by 1 meter, would cause them to move back and forth by a distance of 1/1000th of the diameter of an atomic nucleus. So this is a really small effect. And practical consequences, you can just about forget about it. So far, there's been no direct detection of gravitational waves. Yet we know with almost complete certainty that gravitational waves exist. And we know they exist because of a remarkable discovery that was made at this movie set. There's the second quiz. Who can name the movie set? Or who can name the movies that were filled with the set? Sorry?
GoldenEye
and?
Contact,
right. Well, when it's not being a movie set, this place doubles as the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico, one of the finest radio telescopes in the world. And in 1974, Joe Taylor and Russell Hulse discovered a remarkable pulsar. I've already mentioned pulsars. These are these rotating neutron stars, objects of about 1.5 times the mass of the sun, with radii of about 10 to 20 kilometers. Very condensed, compact objects spinning on their axes. But they discovered one of these things in a binary system with a companion star. The companion star, we now believe, is also a neutron star, but it's not a pulsar. It's a dead pulsar. It no longer emits pulsed radio emission. They saw the still alive pulsar. It's an orbit about the companion with an orbital period of about 8 hours, and it pulses with a period of about 59 milliseconds. But here's where the advance of technology comes into play. With the use of atomic clocks and things like the global positioning system, Taylor and his colleagues have been able to measure the relevant parameters of this system with unbelievable precision. So I said the pulse period was 59 milliseconds, but there's its actual measured value. 0.0590299 blah, 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 blah. And the error there is on the last digit. And there's the orbital period in seconds, 27,906 point blah, blah, blah. Again, error on the last digit. This just illustrates how advancing technology, especially the technology of high precision, allows one to make very precise measurements of these kinds of astronomical quantities. Well, what does this have to do with gravitational waves? Well, I've already mentioned that a binary star system emits gravitational waves. That's a prediction of Einstein's theory of gravity. Those waves carry energy. It's another prediction. They will take energy away from the system. In response to that loss of energy being radiated away, the bodies will spiral toward each other. They'll get closer and closer together. They'll start going faster and faster around each other. And so the orbital period, the time it takes to go around once, will decrease. And it turns out that with all the various numbers that have been measured, you can make a firm prediction from general relativity as to the rate of decrease of the orbital period. And it turns out to be 0.000758 seconds per year, or 75.8 microseconds per year. So that's the prediction of general relativity, and the observed value is smack on within the measurement error. Two, the error here is on the last digit. So again, this is not only a confirmation of the idea that gravitational waves exist, because that's the only phenomenon that could account for such a decrease of the orbit period, but also a quantitative confirmation of the formulas from general relativity that make this kind of prediction in such close agreement now better than a few percent, better than 0.2% with Einstein's theory. But with this kind of confidence that general relativity, that gravitational waves exist, astronomers have now embarked on a mission to detect them directly. This is an indirect detection. We don't see the actual waves. We see the effect of the loss of those waves on the orbit. We'd really like to see those waves themselves directly. And so currently in operation around the world is an array of laser interferometer gravitational wave detectors. The idea of these detectors is to, again, going back to the picture I showed earlier of masses, is to take, when the gravitational wave comes by, two masses move back and forth toward each other. In this case, the two masses consist of a mirror at one end of a long evacuated tube and another mirror here, and a similar mirror at the end of another long evacuated tube over here. And one measures the relative change in distance between the mirrors and the central station by sending laser beams back and forth bouncing off these mirrors, using the laser beams as a way to kind of measure the distance between these mirrors. So this technique of laser interferometry now has been established and put into these detectors. In the US, there are two observatories, one in Hanford, Washington, in the Hanford Nuclear Reservation of the Department of Energy. These evacuated tubes that I described are 4 kilometers long. So these are extremely long devices. And the other LIGO, the other observatory within the LIGO project is in Livingston, Louisiana, not far from Baton Rouge, and it's also a 4 kilometer instrument. And I'm happy to say that the Livingston Observatory did not suffer major damage from Hurricane Katrina. There's a 3 kilometer instrument in near the town of Cascina, just outside Pisa, Italy. That's a French-Italian project. GEO-600, a 600 meter instrument, is a British-German collaboration just outside Hanover. And there's a 300 meter interferometer in Tokyo run by the Japanese. All 5 observatories are operational. The LIGO Observatory is about to enter an 18-month science run later this fall. And after some upgrades and improvements in sensitivity, many of us are confident that within the next 5 to 10 years, they will be detecting gravitational waves from things like colliding black holes, supernova implosions, and the like with regularity. And at that time, a whole new field of astronomy will open up, as well as possible new ways to test Einstein's theory of gravity. Planning is also well underway to put such an interferometer system into space. This is called LISA, for Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. And here, this will consist of 3 spacecraft orbiting the sun, each independently of each other, not connected by any struts, because each spacecraft is 5 million kilometers from the other spacecraft. So they'll orbit the sun in a triangular array that is set in just such a way that as they go around the sun, they retain their triangular shape. All that happens is the triangle rotates around as they orbit the sun. But to first order, they still retain an equilateral triangular configuration. And by sending laser beams back and forth between these spacecraft through the vacuum of space, they will again monitor any relative motions of the spacecraft relative to each other if a passing gravitational wave should come through the solar system. Now, earlier I mentioned that general relativity predicts that space is warped. But it also predicts that space, that time is warped. It really predicts that space-time is curved. So time itself is also warped or curved, in the sense that a clock high in a gravitational field, say at a high altitude, ticks more quickly than a clock on the ground because of the different amount of space curvature, time curvature, in these two locations. So a clock at a high altitude ticks faster than clocks on the ground. Of course, we should keep in mind that moving clocks tick more slowly than an array of clocks in a laboratory. That's due to special relativity. So there are really two effects that, impinge upon the behavior of clocks, the curvature of time and motion via special relativity. Einstein actually predicted this effect in 1907 and then later incorporated it into a general relativity, but it wasn't first measured until 1960 when technology really reached the stage where it could be measured with any sort of prediction. The best measurement so far was done in 1976 by launching into a suborbital flight at about 10,000 kilometers altitude a hydrogen maser clock, which in the 1970s was the most stable kind of atomic clock then known. We have much better ones today, but that was the best known then. And the rate of that clock was compared with an identical hydrogen maser clock on the ground. And the results of that measurement, measuring both the combination of the general relativistic and the special relativistic shifts of the clocks, agreed with general relativity to a few parts in 10,000. So once again, a very high precision confirmation of Einstein's predictions. Well, I promised that I would tell you why general relativity is important in your daily life. And this has to do with the global positioning system. So let me say a few words about what this system is. It's a navigation system that consists of 24 satellites that orbit the Earth. Each satellite carries an atomic clock on board, typically a cesium or rubidium clock standard. Each clock transmits to Earth a coded signal. And the code in the signal tells you when the signal was emitted by that clock, as determined by the onboard atomic clock, and where the satellite was in its orbit at the time that signal was emitted. So if you are sitting here on Earth and you have an atomic clock beside you, you can measure the time when that signal arrives. So if you know when it was emitted from the coded part of the signal, and you know when it arrives at you, what can you determine? Distance, because we know the speed of light, so knowing the time emitted and the time received, you know the distance, can determine the distance between you and that satellite. So for example, if you receive the signal from this satellite and you determine its distance, you then know that you must sit somewhere on this arc given by that distance from that satellite, right? Then if you can get a similar signal from a second satellite, you can in the same way determine that you're a certain distance from that satellite, so you must sit on that arc. Therefore, you must sit at the intersection of those two arcs, so you locate yourself there. If you can do this with a third satellite, then you can, where the three arcs intersect, determine both your location in latitude, longitude, and altitude. And GPS is designed to give you precision measurements of latitude, longitude, and altitude. Now let me see by a show of hands how many people typically carry an atomic clock around with them. Not that many. So what do? Well, if you can see a fourth satellite, then you can use that fourth satellite as a way to determine indirectly, by sort of going back through the mathematics, what your time would have been. This really is, when you're using GPS, solving your location in space-time. You're really doing a four-dimensional problem. You have four unknowns, your local location, latitude, longitude, and altitude, and local time. But you're given four pieces of data, information from four satellites. There's a little chip in your GPS receiver that does all the math for you, but it will determine local position, the 15-meter accuracy for the typical commercial GPS receivers, and you can also determine local time to 15 nanosecond precision. Nanosecond is a billionth of a second. And the GPS array was designed with this number of satellites so that at any moment of time, you can typically see four satellites in the sky. Well, I just explained to you that clocks on satellites up high tick more quickly than clocks on the ground because of the curvature of time. Conversely, however, these orbiting clocks move much more quickly than clocks on the ground, so there must be some offset due to special relativity. Those clocks must be moving a bit slower. But you're saying, well, general relativity is all about very tiny effects. Surely these effects are very tiny or negligible. But in this case, they are huge. They're enormous. The difference in rate between GPS clocks and clocks on the surface of the Earth is 39,000 nanoseconds per day. Compare that with the 50 nanosecond requirement for accuracy for the system to work. Most of this effect is the general relativistic effect, the curvature of time. Then there's a small offset, negative effect, due to the velocity of these satellites of about 7,000 arc seconds. This is enormous compared to the accuracy required. And the system requires that all clocks, Earth and satellite clocks, be kept in sync and be kept at the same rate, all that be understood to this kind of accuracy. So relativity must be taken into account for the GPS system to function. Put differently, if you were to turn GPS on now and not take these relativistic effects into account, GPS would fail to function within a minute and a half, because the errors due to this would be bigger than the requirement for the system to work. So here's a practical everyday application of general relativity when you're landing at some airport in a fog, and you know that your plane is equipped with a GPS tracking system. You can sort of recall that Einstein's looking over your shoulders, helping you to safe landing. Back in the 1980s, the Air Force, which in those days was running GPS, there were only six satellites up at that time, the Air Force became worried about whether or not they were putting the relativistic corrections in correctly. So they asked me to form a small study committee to examine the question and also to look into some other operational issues related to GPS. And so we did, and we did a study and determined, in fact, very quickly that the Air Force was indeed putting in the relativistic terms absolutely correctly. They had all the right formulas, they had talked to the right people, everything was completely kosher, and it was all fine. At the end of our study, I had to make a final report to a body called the Air Force Studies Board of the National Research Council, which runs these kinds of studies for the military. And so I had to give a lecture to this general who was then in charge of the Air Force Systems Command. I had to explain to him a bit about general relativity and why it was important in GPS. So I prepared the simplest lecture I could possibly put together, with the most colorful, flashy view graphs. And I jumped up and down and waved my arms, and his old eyes closed within about 30 seconds. But luckily, his lieutenant back there, she took furious notes during my talk, so I presume later she briefed him on what I said.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.